Silence your cell phones. Dr. Morris Vogel has been the president of the Lower East Side Tenement Museum since June of 2008. He graduated from Brandeis University, then received a doctorate in American Social and Urban History from the University of Chicago, and served on the faculty of Temple University for 30 years as a professor, department chair, and acting dean of the College of Liberal Arts. He has published 6 books on the social history of American medicine, cultural history, and urban history. He has also served as director for the Creativity and Culture Program at the Rockefeller Center. Dr. Vogel is a first-generation American, born in Kazakhstan to a German-Jewish family who escaped during World War II. After living in a displaced persons camp in Poland, his family immigrated to the United States. Today, he will be speaking to us about changing views from New York's Lower East Side Tenement Museum. And it is now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Morris Vogel to you.
Thank you, Mara. Thanks, Mara. First off, does anyone have a really good lunch? No.
I have to do that. I can't see downstairs. Because you can't see.
Nate,
if you can check.
They need to see the PowerPoint. They're still be able to see.
Okay.
Great. The fact that I'm invisible is it's a story of my life. Have any of you been to the Tenement Museum? That's just over half. So a lot of what I'm going to cover today you've seen, but more than half of what I'm going to present you haven't. Thank you so much for welcoming me to Chautauqua. This is the first time that Ruth, my wife, and I have been here, but I'm an American historian by training, and so the story of Chautauqua is an important part of America's story, and it's one with which I have a good deal of familiarity. Can I have the next slide, please? Every professional American historian knows Oscar Handlin's work, and I'm going to use Handlin to frame this talk. Several months ago, in April, the journalist Paul Vitello, who had written Handlin's Times obituary, was quoted as saying that after his first day of reporting to write that obit, he thought that Handlin's was not the most intriguing life. On day two, though, he found one more person to talk to, someone who saw how Handlin's writing had overturned the conventional narrative of the day, of American history, of America as frontier. Quote, "We are a nation of immigrants. That was this guy's concept," the reporter said. "Before that, we were a nation of conquistadors. It was a very big deal. If I had gone with that with what I had the first day, I would not have had this view, this great idea about how this person changed the way we look at America." That's why I put his name and one of his the titles of his books on the screen. Changing the way we look at America is what the Tenement Museum is about. Handlin's insight is old news to scholars, but it's a revelation for many of the 180,000 visitors who come to the Tenement Museum annually. Next slide. That's our newly adopted mission statement. It makes absolutely clear what we're about. For those of you who can't read it, let me read it. I have a lot of practice doing this at board meetings and stuff and such. The Tenement Museum preserves and interprets the history of immigration through the personal experiences of the generation of newcomers who settled in and built lives on Manhattan's Lower East Side, America's iconic immigrant neighborhood. It forges emotional connections between visitors and immigrants, past and present, and enhances appreciation for the profound role immigration has played and continues to play in shaping America's evolving national identity. It's a great mission statement. It also reflects a 6-month process with a 20-member board of trustees to get people to agree that those words were what we are about. Next slide, please. Some historians came to be critical of Handlin, among other things, because of his sweeping generalizations. The Tenement Museum risks generalization to present an integrated American history in which the Jewish experience figures centrally. The Lower East Side was, after all, America's iconic Jewish immigrant neighborhood. The museum grounds the stories it tells in the very specific circumstances of the 7,000 people who lived in our building between its construction in 1863 and its condemnation as unfit for human occupancy in 1935. This photograph is of the museum's neighborhood in its core interpretive period in 1898. It's a view of a neighborhood that is synonymous with the immigrations that built the United States and gave New York its special character. One mark of what might be called the museum's interpretive success came in 2008 when the National Trust for Historic Preservation identified the Lower East Side as, quote, the most culturally important square mile in the United States. The Trust citation also noted that, quote, more of almost everything that is distinctively American has its roots here than anywhere else, end quote. That's a big statement by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. It says that if you want to know the core genius of what this country is, you don't go to Independence Hall, you don't look at the Western Frontier, you don't go to Capitol Hill, you go to the Lower East Side. That's what the museum is about. Can I get us back to... Next slide, please. This is what my predecessor, Ruth Abram, found when she first entered 97 Orchard Street in 1988. This building is now a national landmark. It's listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and it's an affiliated site of the National Park Service, paired by legislation with the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island. The museum has recently been honored twice at the White House, with both the National Medal for Museum Service, which goes to 5 museums in the country every year, and the Presidential Preserve America Award, which goes to 4 entities in the United States every year. And we received it for preserving the memories of America's immigrants. A Reuters story earlier this year on the world's 10 best non-art museums ranked the Tenement Museum 3rd. The only other United States museum on that list of what Reuters at least called the top 10 was the Smithsonian's Air and Space, which came in at 2nd place. I was ready to challenge that ranking because, I mean, how interested can you be in taking orange powder and turning it into ersatz juice? I decided not to challenge the methodology because we finished ahead of the British Museum. And I thought, well, I don't want them to look too closely at that. TripAdvisor ranks 660 New York attractions. People who have been go on TripAdvisor to say what they think. The only museums that regularly finish in the top 20 with us are the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Frick. And as I explained to people, New York City is big enough and rich enough to be able to afford 3 first-rate museums. We carefully maintain some apartments as ruins, as this one is, and we exhibit them as part of every tour. Next slide. Sweatshop Workers is one of our 4 regular educator-led in-building tours. At this point, we have 10 or 11 different tours, 4 regular tours that we do 49 times a day, inside the building. This tour, Sweatshop Workers, used to emphasize work and unionization. That story is still there. This apartment is, after all, a sweatshop. All of our programs continue to struggle to focus on struggle in difficult circumstances. But we've done some reinterpretation of all of our tours. Now this tour, like the others, emphasizes accommodation and identity. how people made their way in this country, how they shaped, how their struggles in this country shaped and reshaped the nation. The sweatshops like this produced half the women's sweatshops like this in this neighborhood produced half the women's clothing made in turn of the 20th century America. They survived on the margins of the economy. They were able to close Saturday and work on Sunday to accommodate religious observance. The Levines and their workers were able to preserve key elements of their religious identities because they lived on the margins. Our educators often compare the position of the Levines to that of contemporary New York City cab drivers who are able to pull over five times a day, pull their prayer mats out of their car trunks, and face Mecca for prayers. All our tours, by the way, connect the immigrant past and the immigrant present. Next slide, please. The Rogoshevsky apartment, is also part of a sweatshop, the sweatshop workers' tour. We used to set that table, present that table as set for Shiva and discuss Abraham Rogoshevsky's death from tuberculosis. I'm a historian of medicine by training. Yes, I know that everyone dies, but most people, at least the record shows, die only once. Why make such a big deal of that? Now we reinterpret the apartment to stress Shabbat, Shabbos. Sabbath observance replaced the morning ritual. Why? There's a change in the workplace in the early 20th century. Fireproof loft factories, like Triangle, Shirtwaist, they replaced sweatshops in that period, harnessing electricity to power machines, consolidating production. These shops move from homes into the lofts. When they do that, they open on Saturdays. That's when factory workers go in. They close on Sundays. There's a regularization of production. That means that for the Rogoshevskys, that there are questions of observance. We know they're Sabbath observant because the little Italian girl who lives across the air shaft is summoned by Mrs. Rogoshevsky on Friday night to put on the gas. She's summoned back to turn off the gas. So for the Rogoshevskys, the key issues are those of negotiating identity. What does it mean to make your way in America? What is it that you keep of your traditions? We know the Rogoshevskys had to work on a Saturday. We know that the dominant Orthodox synagogue on the Lower East Side, the Bialystoker congregation, to this day has a Saturday morning service at 6 a.m. for observant Jews who have to go to work, who therefore go to shul at 6. The regular service is at 8:30, but they have to go in at 6 so they can then go out and earn a living. No matter what interpretation we overlay on these spaces, no matter what points our educators emphasize, visitors are overwhelmed by the stark facts of poverty and struggle. That actually gives us substantial room to reach our visitors. We are, after all, exhibiting 225-square-foot, three-room apartments, all without heat or pre-20th century, without utilities and without plumbing. Next slide, please. This is the first of our programs to use actors to interact with visitors. Victoria is a 14-year-old from the collapsing Ottoman Empire. This is not living history in the usual sense of demonstrating how things were done in the past. Victoria, and there are 10 or 12 Victorias at a time, Victoria interacts with visitors, providing a child's view on making her way in a strange new world, on negotiating her identity in a neighborhood where her Sephardic background made her doubly alien, taking questions out, exploring what it's like for a 14-year-old to figure out a world which she's lived for just over a year. We've recently added Meet Bridget Moore, 1869, an 1869 Irish resident in what was then German Klein Deutschland, because the neighborhood went from being a German neighborhood to a Jewish neighborhood, I do a walking tour that explores how that change happens, how a German neighborhood becomes a Jewish neighborhood. That's a tour that parallels the Victoria Confino tour. Next slide. So what are we doing now? We're installing a major new program that we call Shop Life. There had been a 15-year quest before I got there to develop John Schneider's Lager Beer Saloon in its original 1863 to 1879 home in the basement of our building, 97 Orchard Street. Partially like other interpreted apartments that the museum had presented, it was a feature of the multicultural approach to American history that ran through much of the museum's work, have an apartment on every ethnic group that whose presence we can trace to the museum. Partially, it was also a fundraising strategy, to be absolutely honest. There was hope that the German Americans or German corporations would be interested in sponsoring a German lager beer saloon. Partially, it was also a vision of a food and beer service that would help support the museum. None of those things happened. So next slide. What we're now doing is acknowledging Schneider's as we move beyond the saloon in planning the Shop Life exhibit that will occupy the basement space that Schneider's was originally intended to fill. The Lustgarten family apartment, which we're going to interpret in the rear quarter where they actually lived from 1889 to 1902, the Lustgartens were kosher butchers. Kosher butchers ran up and down Orchard Street storefronts in the 1880s, 90s, and beginning of the 20th century. It's fascinating about Lustgarten, the Lustgarten shop, is that the windows were broken in 1902 when kosher butchers all at the same moment raised the price of meat from 12 to 17 cents a pound, this being the Lower East Side. The women organized, went out, demonstrated, rioted, and chose the Lustgartens to break their windows. What Shop Life will show is how the Lower East Side's immigrants became entrepreneurs by exploiting their marginality. They operated in ethnically protected markets, selling what others couldn't to customers who wouldn't trust outsiders. The 1860s German saloon that we will have there, the 1860s German saloon and the Lustgarten shop broke explicit anti-competitive rules embedded in law and social practice that governed majority communities by selling on the Sabbath. They stayed open on Sunday. They knew that was the way to reach their customers because the Germans observed the Sabbath differently. They had Sunday was their Sabbath, but they spent it in beer halls. Or in the case of the Jews, they observed their Sabbath on a different day. Both the insider market, that is, if you were German, you wouldn't go to an Irish saloon, so you're a captive customer for a German bar. If you were Jewish, you wouldn't go to a German butcher. You'd go to a Jewish kosher butcher. So both the insider market and the willingness to violate community norms to stay open on Sunday offered immigrants competitive advantages. And if you want, Chautauqua is a perfect place to talk about what Sunday closing meant in 19th and early 20th century America, but if you ask that question. Next slide. Immigrant entrepreneurs like Max Marcus, whose Peddler Supplies auction house we are also interpreting in one quadrant of the basement and getting it back to just this condition, though without those guys and their hats and their cigars. Max Marcus violated, and immigrant entrepreneurs like him, violated implicit rules by selling at discount, another violation of community norms. They could do this by holding down costs through self-exploitation and by selling distressed goods, that is, out of season, overstocks, odd lots, and seconds, which their customers valued because they couldn't afford full-priced goods. These folks, and this is the 1930s already, turned the Lower East Side into the city's bargain district. These practices correlate strongly to practices that continue to characterize contemporary immigrant entrepreneurs. So we'll explain where the idea of the bargain comes from, where the idea of violating community norms comes from. The exhibit will argue that America's economic vitality owes in large measure to immigrant commerce. Thomas Friedman, until his, I guess, now he's on something else again, but Friedman was arguing once a week in the New York Times that the centrality of immigrant commerce. And as I explained to potential donors when I'm showing them how this exhibit might work, these immigrants made something out of nothing. And since I'm fairly sure that I don't have any Citicorp managing director when I'm showing off the exhibit, I say, as opposed to Citicorp, which discovered how you could make nothing out of something. Next exhibit. Next slide, rather. Yeah. This is not what it's going to look like, but we're going to use interactives on Max Marcus's counter in the last stage of these educator-led tours to help visitors explore stories for which we won't be reconstructing what we call immersive environments in the new exhibit. This will let us get to Sidney Maida's cut-rate underwear store of the 1950s and 1960s, which was also in that space. One theme that visitors will be able to explore with these interactives, and the interactives are being developed for us by a firm called Potion Design, if any of you are interested in this. They're a bunch of young guys, graduates of MIT's Media Lab. They operate on Canal Street near the museum. They constructed or designed the Star Spangled Banner exhibit for the Smithsonian. They did the classical reinstallation at the Met. They've done the interactive signage for the Morgan Library in New York City. For us, as we like to say, they're doing something really creative. One theme that will come through this work, based on taking an object and putting it on the table and then having 8 to 10 minutes on your own or educator-led to explore something, is the interrelation of commercial and neighborhood history. How a German neighborhood with saloons serving the local community to which Jewish immigrants were attracted, how that gave way to kosher butchers serving local communities as they became primarily Jewish. In the early 20th century, the Jewish population of the Lower East Side declined, and by the 1920s, it crashed. There was no new in-migration after 1921, and of course people wanted to get out. With the decline in Jewish population, shops marketed ethnicity. Come back to the Lower East Side for pickles, come back for smoked fish, to bring dispersed populations back to the neighborhood. And Max Marcus was an example of Sunday sales and other ethnically defined business practices that served citywide populations before you could go to a big box store and find it open on Sunday. There were blue laws. The Lower East Side had an advantage as the rest of the world operated under Sabbatarian or blue law codes. These interactives will also let us bring the story into the present with contemporary immigrant merchants repeating some aspects of the cycle. Next slide. This is our newly opened visitor and education center. It's a terrific facility spread over three floors of a triple front 1888 tenement. A plug, the museum shop is the city's best. Does more dollar volume per square foot than any other. It's a great visible location. We're able to see many more K-12 students, great classrooms, improved visitor services. But, next slide. More importantly is what goes on floors 3, 4, and 5 up above. The new building remained active as a tenement even as our landmark 97 Orchard Street building saw its last residential tenants in the 1930s when the building was condemned. The fact that people continued living there after 1935 will allow us to tell the story of post-World War II immigration. Next slide. In the 1950s, the building provided a home, and those of you who were here yesterday saw a handwritten passenger manifest, a ship's list from the 1882. This is what we're called alien passenger manifest from April of 1947. In the 1950s, the building provided a home to Kalman and Regina Epstein, and I know you can't see it, I've worked on this, whose entries are shaded in yellow at the top. They were relocated in 1947 by Hayas, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Service, under the President's Emergency Directive of December 1945. One reason the Holocaust was the horror it was that there was no way for most people to leave Europe, to leave Germany or Poland or Austria or Czechoslovakia, because the doors had been shut in the United States. Well, in a makeup for American, what some people thought, complicity in the Holocaust, President Truman, in December 1945, agreed to allow 1,000 survivors of the death camps into the United States. And Kalman and Regina Epstein come in April 1947 under the President's Emergency Directive, and they wind up living at 103 Orchard Street, that new building, that spiffy visitor center. They live on the third floor. Next slide. We think that the Epsteins met and married at Zilsheim, a DP camp in Germany. Kalman Epstein had been at Bergen-Belsen and Buchenwald. Next slide. I knew that was wrong. These are the Epsteins' declarations of intention. 1947, they literally got off the boat and filed declarations that they wanted to apply for American citizenship. We want to tell their story, obviously, and the story of the family they raised at 103 Orchard Street. It's in some ways a Holocaust story. More importantly, it's a story of renewal and rebirth. That's not something that is exhibited, just as everything else in our museum is unique, so too would this story be for America's modern history. That story is important also because it's part of the larger story of American immigration, some of what I was talking about yesterday, showing you very different kinds of images. Next slide. Post-World War II refugees were an important part of the American immigration story. And by the way, the first use of the concept of refugee in immigration legislation stems from this period, from 1948. But they didn't repopulate the Lower East Side, which had continued to empty since early in the 20th century as Jews and Italians migrated outward to Brooklyn, the Bronx, and other green pastures. Race-based immigration quota laws, particularly the Johnson-Reed Act of 1924, had effectively shut off the new in-migration by suspect peoples from Eastern and Southern Europe. Come 1940, the American economy needs industrial laborers. It can't get them anymore in Italy or Poland or Russia or Greece. It turns to the American South, to African Americans, or to Puerto Rico, whose residents had been citizens since 1917 under the Jones Act. A substantial Puerto Rican population moved into the Lower East Side in the 1950s and into 103 Orchard Street, attracted to jobs in the Lower East Side's garment shops. And there's a story about Puerto Rican men sew and Jewish men sew, which explains how the neighborhood changes from one kind of population to another. So we're going to tell that story as part of our new exhibit. By the way, you all know West Side Story. Originally, the notion there was to have that be the East Side as the dominant Puerto Rican neighborhood in New York. And as you know, it's a story of gang struggle, or that's the backdrop of it. But that gang struggle is old-time Americans, Puerto Ricans, whose grandparents had been citizens, fighting over turf with newcomers from Poland and Italy, whose parents weren't citizens and who may not have been citizens themselves. Next slide. And we're also going to tell the story of the Chinese tenants who began moving into the building with the expansion of Chinatown in the late 1960s. This image, though, is from New York's very, very small Chinatown of the 1930s. Next slide. Chinatown had been small because of Chinese exclusion dating from 1882. This is a more typical, this one is of a typical tenement that would be familiar to anyone who's visited the Tenement Museum. This dates from the extraordinary expansion of Chinatown that started in the late 1960s. Next slide. That's Lyndon Johnson. That's the city of New York behind. You can see two Kennedy brothers, Lady Bird, and what he's signing there is the Heart Cellar, and he's on Liberty Island, underneath the Statue of Liberty. Two things hold these three diverse stories together. That is Holocaust refugees, Holocaust survivors, Puerto Rican migrants, and Chinese families coming in the late 60s. What holds these stories together, one of those things is captured here in Lyndon Johnson signing the Heart Cellar Immigration and Nationality Act in 1965. That law effectively repealed the 1924 racist Johnson-Reed Act and ended the quota system. And second thing that holds these stories together is that we have families and tenement homes representing all of these three migrations, strands in our new building. What we'll be doing in this new exhibit is telling the story of how, during the civil rights era, Americans regained the confidence to constitute themselves as a people on a non-racial basis. The country rediscovered its soul in the mid-1960s. That, of course, is under challenge in the present. Next slide. The exhibit on post-World War II immigration is going to take a few more years and a couple more million dollars, but we already have $1.6 million in hand because it's a powerful story. It's going to take a few more years to research, plan, and construct, but we've already begun. It's vitally important that we not leave visitors with the sense that immigration is merely the stuff of history. We want them to leave the museum knowing how history illuminates contemporary questions and helps us understand the most important issues with which we grapple as a people. That is, questions that derive from determining who we are as a people. Everything else, no matter how important, healthcare, the economy, none of those things are as important to a people that is as constructed and as imagined as we are, as the determination of who this country belongs to and who has made it and who has made it possible. Being able to address these questions up-to-date exhibit will support our deeper mission of having visitors appreciate that we, all of us have skin in the game and a stake in how our democracy addresses the issue of immigration today. Thanks. Excuse me? Is that what? Orchard and Delancey. Oh, it's gorgeous. Oh, that's her.
So now there's time for questions. I'll bring the microphone to you.
No, it's a square. It's a nice, it's a, give you the dimensions. I go there every day. My wife will testify that I'm sometimes there on Saturdays and Sundays, and And even if I drink the night before, it's square.
Thank you so much. That was fabulous. You mentioned Sunday openings and Saturday closures,
right,
in the sweatshops, and you said it was especially relevant to Chautauqua. So please talk about
it. Thanks for rising to the occasion. In the this country has gone through waves of self-definition, which was my theme yesterday. I dealt with the theme in terms of ethnicity and race primarily. You can also deal with religion. So the American Revolution was meant to create a civil society not rooted in one religion or another, but to offer a wide range of freedom of religion. Thomas Jefferson, as president, thought that government should stay open on Sunday, and the Sunday Mails Act allowed for that, as he put it, for the convenience of Jews, Turks, and infidels. In the 1830s and 1840s, there's the Second Great Awakening, which gains incredible strength and is an important, there's nothing more important than American, I just said immigration was the most important thing. But when I was teaching the survey, I would tell my students that's what they had to learn was the work of Charles Grandison Finney. They had to learn about the Second Great Awakening. Well, people who were converted, reborn in the Second Great Awakening, set themselves to eradicating sin on earth, to developing a community of believers. And how would you have a community of believers? You would regard each the other as not someone you were necessarily competing with, though this was a commercial time. It was a time of growing business. So you would stop competing with each other for part of the week, for the Sabbath. And the Sabbatarian movement gains great strength. By the 1830s, people are asking that the Erie Canal shut down on the Sabbath. That strain runs through a number of institutions, like this one, that in the late 19th century set themselves up as being outside of the flow of American life, of an increasingly immigrant-dominated American life. And so Sabbatarianism goes with revival communities. Revival communities date back to the Second Great Awakening. But the emphasis is on religion, but on community. If you are one in belief in a community, you're not always out to pick the other guy's pocket. You take one day a week off. That, by the way, that's an entire course. I did not do it justice.
Just talk? Clearly the museum thinks that what we now call multiculturalism is a good thing for this country. And yet at the same time, there are many within our political community, those who say, I want my country back, whatever that means, who don't perceive that as a positive. In terms of what you're doing in the museum is sort of assuming that multiculturalism is a positive. Is there ways in terms of how you will deal with those who might not agree?
Really good question. And I'm not going to go off on a discussion of multiculturalism with which we disagree, because we're not talking about separate traditions. We're talking about one tradition. Multiculturalism was an act of compensatory history, getting our picture in because they don't see ours. This is all of our collective story. And so our approach is that this is the American story, that it's not, we're not making up for absence. We're telling the story of how this came to be a single nation. And when I have to speak to, say, congressional staff members, because we get a small, but for those of you who are in the Congress, entirely welcome appropriation each year because we're part of the National Park Service, I have no problem talking to Republican staff directors of the Interior, either the House or the Senate Interior Appropriations Subcommittees, presenting this as America's story. Whether it be entrepreneur struggle or entrepreneurship, whether it be deciding in 1965 that a non-racial policy made sense, those are those are stories that some 10% of the population isn't going to buy them, whether it be on the left, 5% on the left and 5% on the right. On the left, it'll be country was horrible, everybody died. On the right, it'll be they shouldn't have come in. I'm looking at about 90% of the population. And we know we get visitors from all over, and we get them from places like Arizona. And we know that we do a lot of focus groups after visits and a lot of visitor surveys. And we know that our rankings are off the charts, as TripAdvisor tells us. People write in at TripAdvisor and say things like, I didn't realize that this was an important central feature of American life.
When I visited the Tenement Museum, I remember taking a tour of three apartments.
Right.
One was Jewish, of Jewish background, one was Italian, and one was Irish. So it wasn't only stressing Jews.
It's a lot of stories, but it stresses how these various immigrations made and what issues were confronted made us the people we are. Yes. I mean, that's what we want you to see. Though you can't see three apartments on a tour. No, you can only see two. But, we over the year, since I got there, it's a lot. Oh, it's terrible. Nobody dies.
I'm curious if you do any collaborative work with the Eldridge Street Synagogue and perhaps the Chinese Museum, the new Chinese Museum down near Canal Street.
We promote both. We've got the big visitor center on the Lower East Side. We encourage people to visit both. When it comes to Eldridge Street, we hire their best staff members. So there's a lot of connection there. And with MoCA, the Museum of the Chinese in the Americas, they have a new director now, but the interim director before was an old friend of mine from Rockefeller Foundation days. And so we try to find ways to work together. But what we're working together on is not so much program as in visitor services. And we do our own program. We have more history PhDs on staff than the Museum of the City of New York or the New York Historical Society, both of which have budgets 10 times ours. So what we do is we invest in program. And indeed, even during the Great Recession, which is kind of like I walked in the door and said, hi, I'm ready to start work. They said, whoops, there's no money. We decided that what we needed to do was invest in program. And we share what we have, but we really do our own. But if we...
I was going to... another question on a different subject. Could you spell the name of that 1965 Immigration Act that LBJ signed?
Sure. Hart, H-A-R-T, named after Senator Philip Hart of Michigan, and Seller, named after Congressman Emanuel Seller of Brooklyn. Let me take 30 seconds on Emanuel Seller. In 1924... he had voted against Johnson Reed, which is the quota law. I mean, actually, there are a set of quota laws, but that's the core quota law that in effect led to shutting the door to Jewish immigration from Eastern and Central Europe. Seller had voted against that. And given the ways of the House of Representatives, if you were a Southerner, you stayed there forever, or if you came from Brooklyn, you stayed there forever. So in 1965, Emanuel Seller is the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. He's been around 41 years. He's on his 112th term. He had actually shown George Washington, where his name would go on the Capitol. So he is there. Everything we think of as a monument to civil rights, all that legislation that passed in the mid-1960s, the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, all of those laws were passed by a United States House of Representatives that was dominated by Democrats from the South who didn't have really good feelings about extending civil rights to African Americans. Seller chaired the House Judiciary Committee. Every one of those bills that passed because he put together coalitions of Northern Republicans and liberal and I guess liberal Democrats, but Northern Republicans were the key to a lot of that legislation. He put those coalitions together. He could have put his name on any of those laws, and all of them. The one law he chose to put his name on was Hart-Celler, the Immigration and Nationalities Act, because that's the one he'd been fighting for 41 years. You have time for one more? I'm over. You know, 50 minutes is like the... Or if you told me they were graduate students, it would have been 2 hours. I can't.
I'll ask you a yes or no question.
Yes.
I'll even give you the options to answer. As the Lower East Side becomes, like so many other New York neighborhoods, more homogenized and Starbucky, do you think that complicates the mission and programming of the Tenement Museum or makes it more compelling as the neighborhood changes around it?
It's a good question. For a while, the museum had been involved in a preservation effort. We no longer, landmarking effort, we no longer are. That neighborhood was a vital neighborhood. It was vital because it changed. It's the story of change. If someone had said in 1875, oh my God, this Klein Deutschland, the largest German-speaking community in the world outside of Austria and Germany, Klein Deutschland is in danger of being eroded because in 5 years, I hear tell, Jewish immigrants are going to start showing up from Eastern Europe and Poland and Russia and whatever, and all the German beer halls, and there are 400 of them in 1880, are going to be shut, and they're going to give way to tea parlors where you get cake and tea, I need to stop that, but no one did, and what happens is that neighborhood has continued. It has continued to change, and we're about the story of those changes. So those changes are continuing into the present. There's still a very substantial immigrant community in that neighborhood. The public schools are overwhelmingly Chinese in our immediate neighborhood. And if you go over one housing project over, they're primarily Latino. Those are pretty vital stories. We want to be part of telling them.
Okay, this is the last question.
You said that President Truman passed a bill.
No, this wasn't a bill. It was an emergency directive. He could just sign it.
A thousand people who were from the concentration camps
Right. Had
survived.
Right.
It seems to me a paltry sum. Weren't many more people coming into this country after World War II?
Not in 1945, 6, 7. In 1948, the Congress passed the first of two Refugee Acts, the Refugee Act of 1948 and 1949, that each allowed in 50,000 people. Okay, but that was, and by the way, that 50,000 was for displaced Europeans. So the impact of that group of those two Refugee Acts on the Lower East Side was that a very large Ukrainian Orthodox community. She had actually been on the other side in World War II, but had been displaced by the end of war. They sided with the Germans as Germany retreated from Ukraine. The Soviet Union wasn't the happiest place for them to stay. So those two refugee acts allowed 100,000 people in, but a whole mix of displaced refugees. So, but those were the numbers. You get you don't get significant immigration from Eastern Europe till the Hart-Celler. Not till Hart-Celler. You get till 1965. You get the two Refugee Acts.
Thank you very much, Dr. Thanks. Vogel.
We have a pair of sunglasses here with rhinestones. Someone had talked to me the other day. We have found them. So if these are yours, please come claim them.